Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Welcome back this week to Anthologies of Hope for the last of our Conversations Cafe panels recorded live from Hope for the Days Conversations Summit 2019. After this week, all of our future Conversations Cafe episodes will revert back to our much-loved and traditional recording venue at the Sip of Hope Coffee Bar. As always, I'm your host, Rick Osowski, and I'm not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. Thanks again for the great responses from most of our recent episodes, with our Wednesday episodes featuring Amanda Vetrano last week and Casey Ryan this week. If you didn't listen to Casey's episode this week yet, pay attention here because there's some good spoilers you're not going to want to miss. Be sure to check back over the next few weeks for a big announcement that is one I am very excited to share with all of our listeners. And if you have been listening over the last few weeks, this new announcement isn't anything we've covered so far. But circling back to the additional content we are bringing you this season and we can talk about, we are looking to launch our blog next week to bring you excellent writing from past guests and friends of the show. That will be kicking off with the initial blog series titled Eureka, based on inspiration from one of my favorite Comic-Con artists, Monkey Minion Press, and their excellent art book titled Eureka, The Art of Science. Check them out on Instagram at Monkey Minion Press and their website at monkeyminionpress.com to get a head start. On the few off weeks when there is not any Conversations Cafe content on Friday, we will be bringing you a new episode format for this season, the Mental Health Minute episode. These shorter episodes will start hitting the airwaves on a few Fridays in November, covering practical, research-proven tips on how you can approach your mental health care, delivered in a conversational and actionable approach. Starting with two separate episodes to focus on skills and techniques for anxiety and depression, respectively, these Mental Health Minute episodes will be accompanied with blog posts of their own so you can take away concrete courses of action whenever you may need them. Again, a big announcement over the next few weeks, a blog starting most likely next week, and Mental Health Minute episodes in about a month. So now we get to today's Conversations Cafe. Traditionally, Conversations Cafe is a monthly live podcast recording at Sip of Hope Coffee Bar, featuring education and open forum dialogue on the intersections of mental health within our communities on a variety of rotating topics. However, today's Conversations Cafe was recorded live from Hope for the Days Conversations Summit 2019, held during the first Saturday in September at the UIC Forum in downtown Chicago. In America, for people of color, individuals among LGBTQ plus populations, and immigrants, mental health challenges are compounded further by historic elements within America, such as racism, non-secular and secular prejudices, cultural, and language barriers. To address some of the impact and concern around these topics, today's panel is titled Mental Health and Intersectionality, which dives deep to explore the nuances of stigma and mental health in this intersectional context. The guest list this week includes Hannah and Charlie Lucas, creators of the Not Okay app, Brandon Bro, Chicago-based artist and designer, Elise Swopes, photographer, creative, and influencer, Nick Heinman, project manager at SocialWorks, and Dr. Nika Jones-Tapia, currently of Chicago Beyond, and more amazing credentials than we can name in our short intro here. This panel is so full of wisdom, you'll definitely want to be listening to this on 1x speed and have your fingers ready on the jump back button. Of course, as it is a new season, we will be starting a new Spotify playlist to join in with all of our long-form interviews. You can go back and check it out right now at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist, and it has all the songs associated with the first half of Season 3 right now. You can still find Season 1 at anthologiesofhope.com/season-1-playlist, and Season 2 at anthologiesofhope.com/season-2-playlist. Every week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we'll be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you're in a more positive season. If you're in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from Hope for the Day and To Write Love in Our Arms. Hope for the Day can be found at hftd.org/find-help, and To Write Love in Our Arms can be found at twloha.com/find-help. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, at gmail.com. Like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. So today's Conversations Cafe episode, our final one from Hope for the Days Conversation Summit 2019, one you should definitely be taking notes from, mental health and intersectionality. Listen, learn, and enjoy.
Good afternoon, everyone.
Hello.
My name is Carl Evans, Director of Programs and Operations for Hope for the Day, welcome to Conversations Cafe episode Intersectionality. Today, we're live at the USC Pavilion during the inaugural Conversations Summit 2019. And we have assembled an amazing panel together of folks from a diverse range of experiences, ages, and professional backgrounds to talk about the impact of mental health and stigmas within intersections around people of color, economically, identity, and orientation-wise. And we're going to let them introduce themselves in a minute. But just to set the ground floor here, when we talk about stigma, for instance, and over the day, we always define this as social and cultural factors that try to dictate how we express ourselves. And when we talk about mental health within various intersections, there's a few baseline stats. For instance, according to SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Agency, which is a department or is a subchapter of the Federal Department of Health, we know that for people broadly termed as people of color, this includes African Americans, Latinx, and the vast spectrum within the Asian and Pan-Asian community, we see almost a 20% higher rates of reporting mental health challenges compared to those who identify as Caucasian. However, when we also talk about statistics, we know that for those who will identify within the people of color sort of spectrum, according to SAMHSA, we know that they're almost 45% less likely to seek out mental health treatments and have higher rates of discontinuing care. And there's also a strong correlation to economics with this. The lower income bracket you fit into, the harder it is to access mental health services, along with other medical services in general. This is a compounding factor. When we talk about individuals in terms of sexual orientation or gender identity, anyone who fits within the LGBTQ spectrum, we are seeing almost 8 times as higher reported rates of suicide attempts. We are seeing almost 4 times as high self-reporting for depression. And these statistics paint the picture, but we need to put the human experience into it to really give a context. So this panel has been assembled here for folks to not speak for all persons across the world, but to start to get a small bite into understanding what it's like at these different dynamics in terms of talking about mental health with finer nuances. So without further ado, let me have our amazing panel introduce themselves. I'm going to do it a little willy-nilly. Sometimes I'm going to go down the row and back the row, but we're going to start right over here to my right. Start off with Hannah.
Hello, everyone. My name is Hannah Lucas. If you guys were at the last panel, then you know exactly who I am and that you know I love to talk a lot, so I'll try to make this fast. I'm 17. I'm going into my senior year of high school. Pray for me. Wish me luck. Do whatever you got to do. And I created my own mental health app along with my beautiful, extremely tall brother right next to me.
Hi, I am Charlie Lucas. I am a freshman in high school.
Yeah, he's a little freshy.
That's right. I'm 14, even though I'm extremely tall, which is honestly
okay,
very
no
awkward.
No need to rub it in. No need to rub it in.
You're short and no one likes
it. I am. He's like a foot taller than me. But that's not the point. We created our own mental health app called the Not Okay app. It is a digital panic button that for whenever you're not okay, you press the Not Okay app, the Not Okay button, and it will send a text message to your up to 5 pre-selected trusted contacts with a message that says, hey, I'm not okay. Please call me, text me, or come check up on me, along with the user's GPS location and directions to come and get them. And I actually came up with the idea for this after struggling with depression myself. I was diagnosed with a chronic illness when I was his age, actually. I was diagnosed with a chronic illness called POTS, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. Basically, it just caused me to faint and pass out. I missed a ton of school. I was bullied, harassed, sexually threatened by guys in my class who figured out that I passed out. It was awful. I spiraled deeper and deeper into depression, struggled with eating disorders, self-harm, and eventually I had a suicide attempt. But luckily, my beautiful mom, who doesn't even look like her age, saved my life that night. She really did, and that's when I got the motivation and the inspiration to make this app.
So as I said earlier, I'm her brother, sadly. But so after she, so during this time when Hannah was passing out, I sort of became the second and forgotten child. You know, I was pushed to the side. I sort of did all the chores for her. I'm still waiting on you to pay me back for that. Like, what are you gonna get me for my birthday?
But I
would do it all over again if it meant that Hannah would be okay. So I became the second and forgotten child. I was helpless. I couldn't catch her when she fainted. I couldn't drive her to the doctor. I couldn't buy her medication. I didn't even know what was up with her body. So when she told me about her idea for this app, the first thing that I said was, let's go. Because ever since I was about 7, I've been teaching myself how to program because I didn't really have a life. What did you guys do?
Still doesn't have a life.
What did you guys do when you were 7? I didn't do anything. on that very day, I started working on the wireframe and the workflow, which is how the app is going to look and how it's going to work. And then when we were done, and then basically we found developers because at that time I was 12 and it would have taken me like 2 years to finish all of that. And then, yeah, the app became what it is.
Brandon, you're next up.
Hello. My name is Brandon Bro. I'm an artist designer based in Chicago. I've been working, I guess, as an artist professionally since like right before I got out of college. I started doing graphic design and I worked at ad agencies doing some ad stuff or design studios for a while around Chicago. From there, or I guess as far as before that time, I was raised on the south side of Chicago, born and raised. My dad was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia 2 days before I was born, in an episode, like a really kind of like devastating episode. But it left a lot of lack of information and lack of distinction around what was going on with him in his life and what happened in that moment. And I grew up not being around my dad as much, and I didn't know for a long time. I was kind of in the dark about a lot of things. But at the point, you know, I start talking about it with other people, and people actually start talking to me about what was going on. I noticed that there was a lot, like a lack of conversation around these type of things. But because I had a close association with someone in my life and something that happened in my life, I had a different understanding. And I saw everywhere in the world that when I would go places, I would see how people weren't talking about this thing. I would see people who would be dealing with something or be having an episode, you know, outside in public having an episode, and people kind of ignoring that, not knowing how to manage it, and just pretending like it didn't happen. And I was in a dance group in my early teens, or throughout high school. I started like dancing because I was really looking for like a form of expression. I was experiencing some depression at the time. I didn't know what that was, some sort of anxiety and depression at the time, and I was looking for a way to kind of have a voice. And I found dance. And dance is great because it's an amazing confidence booster, and it really propelled me and put me, like, you know, in this place. But even at that time, there were people that we would encounter in different dance groups that were dealing with something, whether it's depression or whatnot. And I just, like, noticed that there was not a lot of compassion in that space, and there was not a lot of empathy in that space. And it comes directly from not having those conversations and not talking about those things. And I think about the people who are in just positions to have a voice and that do have platforms, but if the subject matter has a stigma associated with it, how often do they actually get to speak about it? How often do they actually get asked about it? And it just became important to me that whatever I did in my life or through my art, I should really speak to how I actually feel and my experiences coming up. So my having like a mental health awareness being a part of my art practice is something I was doing really early on. And it was sort of like this indirect thing. It was like this conceptual thing. But then I think lately the conversation has been a lot more direct for me. Like having that conversation through the work, having that conversation through the art, and it's proven to kind of resonate with people. because a lot of times, like I did this t-shirt a couple years ago and it said mental health is real. It was like on the front of the shirt, and it just gave an opening to have an authentic conversation. Because I've been in the arts field for a long time, and we would have all of these events, we would do all these social gatherings, and we would have the whole night would be small talk. You know, you go out, you interact with these people, and there's just this same thing. So, you know, the idea behind it was like have an opening for a real conversation. So that's how the mental health is real thing started. And I find that to be something that I want to continue to do through the art and having interactive experiences that inform people, that educate people, and have us build a greater sense of empathy for one another and our different situations. I think as I was growing up as an artist, as a young man, I think there was an emphasis on art, how I was creating art from the Black perspective, you know, and for me, I wrestled with that because I felt that it was so much more, and I felt no one was actually talking about what people were really experiencing. No one was really talking about mental health awareness, and I felt like that related to everybody. So, you know, I try to have a broad conversation, and there's layers, you know, there's layers to our personal experiences and who we are as well. So, yeah, I just talked about a bunch of stuff, but that's kind of like where I am and where I guess my heart is, and you know, these conversations and doing public works. On the other side of this wall, I have a piece called On the Line, and it's pretty much a table with four rotary phones, and the phones are programmed that when you pick them up and you listen, they tell you a fact or a statistic about mental illness in the U.S. They give you someone's personal story, you get a poem, or you get a definition of a mental illness or condition, right? And that's the whole thing, right? How do you create these engaging experiences and how do I borrow from these nostalgic moments in my life, like, you know, the rotary telephone and these things, right, to kind of create a tangible real life experience for today. So that's where that came from. I don't know if you even asked me to talk about all of that, but I wanted to do 5 minutes of time at least. So, yeah, that's pretty much.
Now, this conversation is just, we got to go where it goes. So Ms. Elise.
Hi. How are you, everybody? My name is Elise Swopes. I am from the suburbs of Chicago. I grew up in the suburbs, and I moved to Chicago in 2008. I learned graphic design when I was 9 or 10 years old. I owned my first website when I was in sixth grade, and it taught everyone else how to create websites themselves. I had HTMLs. I had graphics for free for people. It wasn't until 2010, eventually, skipped some time, where I started Instagram, and I eventually just started creating stuff with my phone, and that's what I primarily do to this day. Is I'm a mobile photographer and creator. I call myself a visual storyteller. Today I've got 250,000 followers on Instagram, so I basically leverage that with brand partnerships, and I get to travel the world and do really crazy stuff. I actually just came back from Dubai/Maldives with Jada Pinkett Smith and Will Smith. I was shooting something with Jada down there for a week with their family on vacation, which was super crazy. But it really ties back to mental health, because for me personally, I've been through a lot from drug use to just mental health to just growth and accountability. And to be where I'm at today and to say that I have had a past of suicidal tendencies and I have had a past of serious mental health and rehab situations, but to be on the other side and go to the Maldives with the Smiths and to say that I did that now and to keep working through all those negative things that could stick with you if you allow it, is a really powerful thing for me. So to keep continuing and to push through meditating, through writing, through consistency, through routines, for me was one of the biggest things, and being accountable and taking responsibility for my life and my health mostly. But yeah, so that's a little piece of me. There's so much more though, but honestly, I'm just so excited to be here with all these really wonderful people. So thank you so much.
Okay, first of all, I just want to say your story is incredible.
Thank you.
And second of all, I'm just warning you now that I'm going to hide in your suitcase next time you travel with Smiths. Okay?
you're small enough. I'll fit you right in. You're good. You got carry on.
That works, man.
Yeah.
That was great. Thank you, Elise.
I love how he's become the Instagram king within an instant.
It's video production. They have a really crazy team. They
really
have a wonderful
creative
team.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, you see things that you just haven't experienced in content yet.
Well, I'll tell you why. It's because they ask other people. They collaborate with creators who are everyday people, and they want to help regular people. It's the best thing.
I see that, and he shouts them out and supports them. And that's mental health. Supporting each other is always mental health and mental wellness. In my life, the best parts of my day is where I can relate with one of my peers or feel a little bit of embracement. And I think that's the most important thing. Introductions. Hi, I'm Nick Heineman. I'm a project manager at Social Works. We're a local nonprofit here in Chicago. But about me, I think like I always try my best not to like retroactively think about my life and look back and reflect in a negative place. But I like to think about the steps I took to get where I am, and I'm happy to share a little bit of those, and thank you to everyone who shared their story, because especially going towards the end, you just built up my confidence as it comes through. But again, you know, now that I find myself in the organizing nonprofit space, it came from a set of experiences from when I was young up until my late 20s, where I was trying to change from within and change from within for others. Before Social Works, I worked in youth rights and advocacy in our juvenile detention center for a few years. In that space, what I was able to observe as a reflection of my own mental health was that isolation, but to a point where it was systematic and expected and assumed. And it was just a natural part of your life. And that's a devastating thing to view, not only as an individual and a human, but somebody who's a part of a group that's perpetuated that space existing in the first place. So there was a few years there where if you ever have programming that can go into the detention center, please bring it there and then see what you can do for those youth as they leave the space as well. But there I really got to just, you know, put a backseat to my mental wellness, not in a space of self-care, but in a space of priority. And through that prioritization, I was able to just feel a little better myself. Before that was Department of Child Family Services. At this time, we were still referring to youth then as wards of the state. Now they're just youth that need us, and they always have been. Working with youth who saw their mental health and their mental wellness as a prescription more than a choice. So when you are involved in a system that makes your choices for you and tells you where you're going to go and what's going to happen if you were to do this, that, or the other, you're often finding a therapist out of a forced situation, and that can lead to a stigma that's almost irreparable. So when you care for somebody else, or you're a caretaker, a parent, I just always ask that you have that conversation with somebody before suggesting what might be that next best step for them. Prior to that, in the precipice of everything in my life, I worked in a few years of law enforcement as well. As a youth who was victimized in a way that was very hurtful and still to this day affects me every day, I thought there was a space in law enforcement where you were the one who could save kids from being hurt like that ever again. And my ignorance and misperception of what law enforcement was quickly realized. And even in that space, as a member of the LGBTQ community, there are so many people participating in a system that's wrong and broken, and they themselves are wrong and broken. So, you know, being a male in that space, I definitely felt shadowed and hidden amongst a group of people who are also probably, you know, using negative ways to reveal how they're really feeling. And that's been my life growing up to Social Works. Again, each step has been a progress point for me, I think. And as I recently publicly identified, you know, who I am in the past few years now, anyone who's working towards that, grab me after. We can talk about how it was awful and how it was great at the same time. And it continues to grow as a great thing rather than a negative thing. So I'm just happy to be here with everybody and speak a little bit to the experience I've had in feeling not only just prejudice, but realizing that prejudice exists so much more strongly for those in my community and people of color in my community, because I still have it easy.
Thank you very much, Nick. And I think you're good to go. I mean,
Yeah. first, I have to say, I hope someone in the audience is like Snapchatting or tweeting this picture or something, because I am getting ready to get so much street credibility with my kids right now for being on this panel with everyone. You guys are so awesome. But welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Nika Jones-Tapia. I am a clinical psychologist. When I said that, I saw these phones go up. So please tag me so my kids will like know how cool I am. I am a clinical psychologist and the first leader in residence at Chicago Beyond. Chicago Beyond is an impact investor focused on youth equity and justice. Our founder, many of you may know, Liz Dozier, was the former principal at Fenger High School, incredible woman. And Liz really wanted to better support our young people growing up on the south and west sides of Chicago. And so to date, Chicago Beyond, in the last 3 years, has invested more than $30 million in 14 nonprofit organizations on the south and west sides. And I am the first person that they have invested in, and my focus is all on mental wellness and trauma for our young people. You know, prior to taking on this role, I was the warden at Cook County Jail. And I hear someone laughing, oh my gosh, you must know my experiences at Cook County Jail. Yes, I know your face. I was the warden there for 3 years and the first clinical psychologist in the country to run a correctional institution. And thank you. but it was not an easy job. You know, Nick talked about isolation that was seen in the juvenile correctional facility. And in addition to isolation, you see this sense of hopelessness come upon people who are engaged with the criminal justice system. And so our focus at that time was really around building up mental wellness supports and trauma supports, as well as education and job readiness skills, so that people who had become involved in the criminal justice system could find their way out and stay out. And so I left the jail in March of 2018, and yes, and really wanted to focus on how we could better support our young people before they became involved in the criminal justice system in hopes of stopping that cycle. And so we've been doing a few programs that I'm sure we'll get into a little later today, but I'm a Chicagoan by heart and not by birth. So this is the part of the story where the movie will like cut to my childhood. And so, you know, like if you're familiar with the Spike Lee movies, this is the part where I'm like walking, but it's like a floating and it's showing. Yeah, you know that part of the movie, right? So it's showing my childhood. So growing up, I was the youngest of three children in a two-parent household. We were, you know, poor, I think, by other people's means, but rich by our means because our house was rich with love. But when I was 8 years old, I watched my father get taken away by officers for possession of drugs. And he was incarcerated for about 2 years at that time. And, you know, prior to that moment at 8 years old, my father had been in and out of correctional institutions, but it was that moment where I actually experienced my father being taken away that I think changed the trajectory of my life. And looking back on that now, I realize that I'm able to sit in front of you as what I would say is a successful Black woman who grew up with an incarcerated parent because I had the support of my community, I had the support of my family, and I also had an ongoing relationship with my dad. And in my experiences at working at Cook County Jail and other correctional institutions, I see that so many of our young people don't have that support. And so what we're really trying to do now is better promote this idea that we are not a part of what our parents did or what our loved ones did. We are better than our worst behavior. And with support, there's nothing that we can't get past. And so that's why we really wanted to, you know, take a step back and really begin to focus on what we could do centered around healing and wellness so that we can, you know, promote our successful young people who are incredibly resilient. So that tells you a little bit about me and how I got here. But thanks. I'll be looking for that street credibility with my kids when I get home.
Thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for sort of sharing a little, touching into the background here. And where we really want to go here is intersectionality as a topic can also be kind of sloppy and messy. We don't want to compartmentalize. We don't want to say this is one discussion and this is the next discussion. But there's also so much that even if you use intersection as a code word, there's also different things. And if you listen, and especially if you're listening to what they were talking about, when we talk about economic factors, that then is a compounding factor into how someone might end up in a criminal justice situation. That is going to be impactful on how someone's going to engage their mental health. But then you talk about social and cultural factors and how someone comes to embrace their sexual orientation, for instance. It can be challenging in any spectrum on any piece of geography, but then there's going to be other cultural barriers that impact that too. So instead of trying to like compartmentalize, what I'd like to really do is hear from all of you to sort of talk about how you've seen stigma impact mental health from your perspective, like wherever you've seen it, whether that's just to yourself personally or just in your travels and experience. And this, take it wherever you want to go, as broad as you want to go. There's no such thing as rambling. That's a time cue, but that's it. So I jump in.
Yeah, if I can start, you know, I think so many of us will touch on different topics. And I started talking about my experiences being a child with an incarcerated parent. And what I realized when I first started talking about that was that this is a population of people that we don't see. We hear a lot of people talking about criminal justice reform and so many people talking about this. However, they're not talking about the reality that children are the hidden victims behind mass incarceration. And we, as long as they continue to be these hidden victims, then that means they're not allowed these safe spaces to talk about their experiences. And that also means that that isolation and that shame and that stigma is more likely to become internalized and more likely to result in a negative trajectory. And so what we've started to do is to highlight the need to not only have the conversation, but to identify ourselves and realize that we are our own support system. And so nationally, we know that 2.7 million children right now has an incarcerated parent, but we don't have supports for them. And it was in recent times that we partnered with the Cook County Sheriff's Office, where we asked them to ask fathers and mothers coming in how many children they have under the age of 18. And would you believe that here in the county of Cook, in the last 6 months, we have 37,000 children whose parents are incarcerated? 37,000 children in the last 6 months, and we don't know who they are, nor are we providing supports for them. And so when we talk about shame and stigma and isolation, I want to highlight different populations of people that have historically been invisible, because we have to make them feel visible and offer supports so that they can know that they have a support community around them.
We compartmentalize more often because it's easier, I think, as a public and a society as a whole, which is always the worst statement to precede anything. But as a whole, we need to start to identify these spaces and be mutually supportive of all of them. So I think stigma, I've been relating stigma a lot lately to peer pressure. And what I mean by that is that whenever we see someone we love or believe in or trust in say something, we're usually going to trust and believe in what they're saying. Somebody that we look up to, it could be of influence or not influence, but I see the pressure needing to be on each other. I think stigma is something we talk about. I think that that follow through is something that no matter where we talk about stigma being present is something we have to actively train our brains to keep thinking about. Someone mentioned about saying hello to somebody walking down the street earlier on one of the panels, and I so relate to that because in the past few years, I do make it a point, anyone walking alone, to try and make that eye contact if they're willing, because not everyone's going to have that moment of, you know, solidarity with a stranger, nor do they want it, and that's the space. But the more often you look to others to do just that, it's going to happen a lot, and it's going to exhaust you in a way that feels relaxing and good, because you know those little instances of relatability is stigma in its own sense. It's support from somebody that you don't know, and most likely that person that just gave you that hello, how you're doing, you could trust in them to say they wouldn't judge me. So the more people we see as non-judgmental, the more stigma eradicates. And another big thing on stigma, just quickly to close it up, is, and it's not my favorite piece to eradicating stigma, we see pop culture. I mean, for me, I'm only 30, but from my like 15 to 25, like, it wasn't in the conversation like this, mental health and wellness. It was within the community, within ourselves as professionals and the consumers we were working with. But in a mass level, almost in a sense that it's, you know, righteous and right on, I think that's a really powerful way to keep it moving forward. But that doesn't fix access to stigma-breaking systems. So Just wanted to say, though, if pop culture keeps going, maybe we'll see a little more applicability in the masses.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think over time, of course, compared to 10 years ago, a lot more people were having a conversation. And I think the question, I mean, at that time, the statement that I was trying to make was like, this stuff is real. This exists. Stop ignoring the people who are kind of crying out for help and like saying they need help. And, you know, and it's right in front of everybody. And now what's, you know, occurred to me is the shift where I try to take my work is, all right, how do you add distinction to what's going on, to that thing, right? And in order to actually be able to relate to it, and how do you make those conversations more public so that the media starts to sort of reflect that, and it's not just like these just statements of, oh, mental health is this thing, and you're starting to hear it in the media. Now you're starting to hear distinction, like in the media, right? And I think media is a very interesting thing, because media is also that thing that kind of helps stigma, these stigmas that do exist, live and keep surviving, right? I think, you know, we are projected images of ourselves and how we should be that often impact us, that often amount to how we end up identifying with ourselves. And in many ways, right? I feel like that is something that with the invisible space that I try to like really challenge the pre-existing narratives and notions that exist, right? And I think it's really important to be in a space to do that, because there is so much media and there's so many things that keep us in these spaces that we know ourselves as, and we've been grown to know ourselves as, not even all the time because we made specific decisions, because we've been told who we are, whether it's at a very young age or not. So, I think this idea of erasing or like combating stigma is very powerful when it's actually given a space to grow and be beyond what you would expect from a certain situation or expect to come out of a certain place. Because then people get to see themselves, and like the youth get to see themselves differently. If we're actively having conversations about these things that do exist, these invisible things that do exist, that might have you think that, oh, I can't develop an app. Well, I can't do that because there's no one around me that's doing that type of stuff. And I don't see any reflection of that in the media being projected. So how does that even a possibility for something, you know, for my future that I can possibly see in my future? So I think I spoke about it a little earlier, how I felt like stigma was impacting my experiences of the people around me sort of growing up, right? In these ways in which it was just not a part of our normal conversation. We weren't loving to one another. We only had a certain level of like being loving to one another because there was no examples. And I don't know what this is you're dealing with. Don't talk to me about that. Like, I can't talk to you about this right now. You need to talk. I had people in my past, like friends, like very close friends of mine, actually say that because they just didn't have the capacity to have the conversation or did not know how to have the conversation. And I literally had to like, you know, we had to end conversation at that time and seek that, you know what I mean? In other places, talk to people in my family, talk to other folks. So I think it's very much still there. And I think the challenge is like the actionable, at least for me, is really trying to find ways to explore the unseen, to imagine the thing that I don't even have an image for yet, right? Create space to be able to see space, like where we haven't gone yet, right? And I find excitement in that. I'm inspired about the uncharted territory or the way that, you know what I mean? Like I really am. So I don't know, you know, I see it everywhere. I see it all the time. And I like building and I like conversations like this because it kind of gives ideas and ways to go to think beyond the box and outside of the box that's in the box. You know what I mean? And the multiple paradigms that exist that we kind of are unaware of a lot of times.
I dig that. You're about to jump in there, Lisa.
Yeah, I mean, I try to break the stigma of mental health every single day with the way that I exist and the way that I approach my work and the way that I explain who I am and what I do, because people expect to have all these nice things and do all these nice things without an effort of failure. But for me, I think all my failures have really propelled me to where I'm at. So I think when it comes to like my podcast that I have, when it comes to my writing, when it comes to the TED Talk I just did at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, I was extremely adamant about being as transparent as possible, because it's not about all of my wins. It's literally about all of my losses. And it's not that I'm dwelling on them so much as that I'm so grateful for them every single day of my life. And it's kind of wild to think that like there was a lot of people who wanted so much for me when I was really struggling a lot. And it wasn't until I really wanted something for myself that everything really shifted. And I tried not to be as preachy, but more as an example to people to show them that you can push through and you can really be something bigger than you had ever envisioned, pushing past what you thought was going to break you, right? My biggest thing right now is I've got a mobile photo class with some kids in the West Side, and I go visit them every month and we do these classes. And the thing about for me is that I came from absolutely nothing as well. I literally built all of this from the ground up, of course, with the support of my parents, which isn't to be, you know, ignored. But for me, coming from a place where I didn't have any expensive equipment, I had nothing. I literally had a broken iPhone 4, and that's what I used to create something for myself, and using a free platform like Instagram, and coming from a place where I felt like there wasn't much assistance or help or anything. And so I kind of, it really felt like I had to learn everything I wasn't to become who I am today and who I wanted to be. And so with that being said, I think that's the stigma I'm really trying to break when it comes to success and how hard it is to push through all of that, because that's really what makes all of this worth it at the end of the day, is looking back and realizing that you really thought life was complete crap at some point. You really feel low. You're lowest. I mean, that's when you break apart, and then that's when you can kind of pull yourself back together in this really beautiful way. So yeah, that's something extremely important to me. Extremely.
Wow. That was really good.
Thank you. Thanks.
On the topic of stigma. So in the Black community, stigma towards mental health is really strong, because everything in the Black community is a demon. Like, you just pray it away and pray it away and pray it away. And if it doesn't work, you know what you do? You just pray it away some more, you know?
Throw holy water on it. Get that anointing oil.
But I know this from personal experience, because when Hannah was struggling with depression earlier in her 9th grade year, all my dad did was try to pray it away. He didn't try to take her to a therapist or anything. He just tried to pray it away and keep on trying to pray it away. And I think that that's honestly what we're trying to do a lot of the times in the Black community, instead of actually going out and reaching out for help, because there's also the stigma around reaching out and asking for help, especially around Black men. And it's honestly not okay.
I think for me, in my personal opinion, with my personal experiences, I've come to learn that stigma and stereotypes are really similar. Stereotypes are something that everybody, quote unquote, everyone believes to be true, and everyone talks about like it's true. And stigma is something nobody talks about, you know? Like nobody talks about, nobody chooses to think about. So I think that they're really similar. And I think that with both of them, a solution can be to go talk to different people, you know, have different conversations, you know, back to what Charlie was saying with, in the Black community, that could have been solved, I think, by talking to people, you know, breaking out of your comfort zone and having those difficult conversations. That's literally what our app is all about. Because it can be hard to start those conversations, but the minute they're started, it gets so much easier, and we're all like, oh, wow, I didn't know you struggled with this too. Actually, in my youth group in church, the moment I was like, okay, I'm so sick and tired of this, like, yeah, I struggle with depression. Sure, I had a suicide attempt. That doesn't make me crazy. I'm not demon possessed. I'm fine. Sure, God is still working in me, but, you know? And the moment I started talking about that, the more the other girls were like, I didn't know that you struggled with it. Like, I didn't know that we were allowed to be in the church and be Black and struggle with this and still be strong. So
I just wanted to acknowledge, too, that I think I personally have experienced times where I might have wanted to go and talk to someone, but just didn't feel that I was capable of going to talk to someone and didn't really trust anyone around me to talk with. And so to individuals who have those moments and when they are in those moments, I'd love for us to talk about what we would suggest for them. Like I personally feel as a mental health clinician that more mental health clinicians need to step outside of our offices and go into the communities and engage with people so that it's not incumbent on the person to reach out to us. You know, one young man I spoke with really called the mental health community out on the carpet, and he is from the South Side. And he said, you know, when a disaster happens, like a tornado or a hurricane, the American Red Cross will send crisis workers out into communities. And he said, well, everyone knows that we're in a state of crisis right now with trauma, but who's coming to rescue us? And that really put me in a step back and said, you know what, like we have to do more to reach out to people when we know that they are in these experiences and having these moments where it is incredibly difficult to reach out. So we have to reach in sometimes too.
We find ourselves in positions where we feel like we won't be able to relate to somebody, and it's that first attempt and try. So that's all I wanted to say. It's a bravery. It really is.
And that's great, because this is one of the most important things that we've got to consider here. Why people try to even navigate into this whole idea of intersectionality and all these things is representation. It's visibility. These are conversations that were not had. There was a default conversation. And then if you didn't fit in that, that's as much as what shapes stigma is not fitting the status quo. You know, stereotypes are part of that too. Like it's in a reinforcement thing. So I think, you know, with the time that we have here, I think what would be really important is, okay, we could make a list. There's 1,000 things, you know, boys don't cry. Women should be like this. There's no such, you know, the impact of religion, affirming spirituality and all that. But I think what would be really important here is from each one of you represent an opportunity of impact and raising the visibility and bringing this conversation in through the digital app, through artistic platforms, through digital platforms, especially in the direct services and the direct communications and community work. So bouncing right off of what you're talking about, what would be, from your perspective, what are things you think can make the positive impact for people who just aren't represented, who don't have the words and don't have access to being taught the words for these conversations? You know, we'll run it back down this way and just sort of, what do you think would help? What do you want to do? What do you think can help?
Well, kind of a topic at our house is if there's not a spot for you at the table, or if you don't feel comfortable at the table, make a table with many seats that you feel comfortable at, to make people like yourself feel comfortable and that where they have a voice. So what I mean by that is it's almost kind of self-advocacy in a way. So when my brother and I speak to kids in high school and in college where they have the opportunity to make clubs, we often encourage them to make clubs where they feel safe, where they feel comfortable. Like the Black Student Union. You know, I live in a predominantly white area. So it's like all the Black kids at my school, we all have telepathy, you know, or what is it? Telepathy or telekinesis? I don't know. Telepathy, you know, we all see each other in the hallway and we're like, what's up? We don't even know each other's names half the time. It's like, I see you, man, you know? So we have the Black Student Union. It's a place where we can all come, where we can all feel at home, and we don't have to try hard to fit in, where we don't have to try not to be, quote unquote, too Black, you know?
To piggyback off of what Hannah said, when you don't have a spot at your own table, you have to make your own. Like, especially with people my age, we look up to adults who look down on us and who tell us, like, especially with our app, they just look at us and they're like, oh, that's a cute little thing that you've got there.
No, the thing that they say is, you're the future. Nice job, sweetie. And I'm like, the app is now. Like, it's live. It has over 80,000 downloads. Like, you know?
We're not the future. We're the now. But seriously, though, we look up to adults who look down on us and who tell us that we're the future, but we're ignored now, and it's honestly not fair. So we need to start making our own tables. And another way that you could actually get that out there and actually get people to see themselves in other things is we definitely need more media representation for Black teens, Latinx teens, like definitely Latinx teens, because Latinx teens have the highest rate of suicide among their peers, and we really need to fix that. Yeah. Like, seriously. So yeah.
Yeah.
It's more just of a problem. Like, what do we feel can help combat and help celebrate, you know, bringing out the visibility and working against these stigmas?
Yeah, I mean, I can honestly say, you know, I don't know. That's a huge question for me, you know. And I think what I do as an artist, my practice is like investigation and investigating ideas and different methods and different approaches for providing more visibility. Like I got an opportunity to create a store on the South Side, so. For me, it was about this conversation. I wanted to bring light to that. And the title of the name of the store is The Invisible Space, right? And it just kind of speaks to like these narratives coming from this place that people seem to ignore or act like isn't there, right? And it's the same way people's perspectives act like they aren't there, right? You don't see them on TV, you don't see them in these places. So, you know, I think it's really finding creative ways to speak to it and speak to other experiences. I mean, I love animation as a medium for telling different stories, different narratives. So in fiction and in nonfiction, whether it's really documentary style media. But I really feel like the media, the power of media is evident, is major, is powerful, like media itself. And it is how you use it. I mean, the past couple of years been seeing how media has been used to misrepresentation, right? With these old ideas of like fake news. And I think it's really up to us to kind of to commandeer like the platforms and that thing, right? Social media has been like a huge way in which people are still having a voice despite what networks are pushing out and all this other stuff. But I think it's important for us to also own our own platforms, because then you can speak to what Facebook did and Cambridge Analytica, you know, all of that stuff that ends up happening. So that's even a gray area. So I think we, like, people who don't have those voices also need to start creating their own platforms to get information out as well. Yeah.
Yeah, true that. I mean, that's jumping off of what everybody says. You know, if you don't have a seat at the table, make your own. You know, if it's for me, I try to be, like I said, as transparent as possible. I try to be an example through my perseverance. I really don't want to be too preachy about it, but the biggest thing I try to do is every podcast that I have, I do it every other Sunday. The topics are mental health. It's about how to just walk yourself through any kind of situation. I'm very transparent about whatever I've been through on there. I'm also writing a book right now that I've been writing these affirmations every single morning for 2.5 years now. And I'm going to put them in a book. And throughout those affirmations, I'm also going to put why I needed those affirmations, what experience I had that I needed to use that for. And it's not so much about like faking the positivity. It's about being very realistic about what I need that positivity for. So I think the biggest thing for me, is just trying to be myself and to tell my story as much as possible in any possible way. You know, we're talking about the media and trying to be more represented, I can't say the word and I'm over it, on the media, you know, but like Brandon said, we're our own media. And that's the most important thing, is we have to speak from ourselves and use our platforms, because, I mean, there's all different types of influencers in, and I'm speaking in my business now, but there's micro influencers, there's macro influencers, there's celebrities, and then there's like even bigger than that. And so like, we have to understand that even if we don't have these certain follower account numbers or whatever, we are our own influence in our own communities and in our own networks. So we have to be sure to be honest, be hopeful, be true to ourselves, and to be an example rather than someone who, you know, feels like you have to say something, but say it because you want to say it and you feel like it's you know, going to make you feel better. And I think self-love and self-growth is the biggest thing. You can't help others around you until you help yourself. So always being sure that you're putting yourself in a place where you're eating healthy, you're you know, working out to a certain extent if that's for you, and doing certain things that will make you feel good in your human body, because your body matters. Your soul is in there for a little bit, so enjoy it while it lasts, okay? Yes.
I love the affirmation. I think that's super cool. I think that's really important.
It's changed my entire life. It's because my brain was so wired to think so negatively for so long that I knew that my brain was a muscle just like anything else in my body, that the more I practice something, the more I can implant it in my brain. And I've realized that for a fact that has happened. Yeah.
Shout out to this event in general. I'm getting a lot of great feels. Thank you, Carl, and Hope for the Day, Sipa, Hope, Johnny, Mike, Ben, everyone who did this. I heard a lot about a seat at the table, saying things because you mean it, and we're talking about visibility and access. I hope I don't offend anyone. Oh, SocialWorks has a booth back there. We are building a guidebook, visibility, access. We're doing great work with a lot of really meaningful people. That's not why I joined this panel today, to talk about that. If you want our email, any one of our great team members' emails, go see us. We can get on a call, talk more about what we're doing. It's a lot about that visibility piece. But white people within the LGBTQ community, we have a seat at the table. I hope I don't offend anybody, but I do mean what I say, and I like to say what I mean because it makes me feel good. We have a seat at the table. There is a priority to work and organize and find your passion to create another seat. And if we're going to be creating curriculum through legislative demand, I think it should be a more wholesome conversation. I see harm that can come from this kind of prioritization that's not coming from a represented community. And we see how impactful and immediate this kind of thing can become. I'm sorry, it was a very frustrating day for me to see that, because we've made it so far in the space that the LGBTQ community has this voice and this impact, but in the influence of media, it's being shifted into the priority of the conversation. And I don't know if that's so the media can compensate that they're doing some sort of good and fighting for a cause, but I certainly don't see the representation of the need and the urgency of that need being put forward in the space. If we can use law to make classes, if anyone wants to organize to start making some new curriculum and push for it, let's do it, because that wasn't representative of our community, and it could be harmful in the end. So just before you create visibility, think of everybody.
What can we do to combat stigma? I think a few things. One, the first that comes to mind is creating safe spaces, whether that's in our home, in our one-on-one conversations with people, or in larger groups like this. You know, we don't oftentimes have the opportunity to really share what's going on with us or to just listen. And so I think the more that we create spaces like this and those one-on-one conversations, then we can really better explore how we can support each other. And a second thing I would say is, in those safe spaces, being free to talk about your personal experiences when you can. I think as someone who has experienced adversity, it's my responsibility to share with others that just because we experience a mental illness doesn't mean we're doomed. Just because we have experienced trauma doesn't mean that we're doomed. And I think we approach things so many times from this deficit mentality that lends itself to stigma. And so when we can show people that that's not the case, then I think we're be more open to talking about our experiences and working through those, and then hopefully taking steps towards the healing and the wellness that Soaps talked about. And then lastly, I would say, you know, just understanding that we will all have moments when we need someone else. And so when we are having a better moment, taking the time to engage with others, a smile will go a long way. Nick talked about eye contact. And I think through those three things that we can not only begin to target stigma, but begin to just approach life with more humanity and more love and kindness. So those would be the three things that I would offer.
And that's perfect. I think that that's a wonderful way to wrap up this panel, because as I said before, this is too big and too complex to patronize or thinking we're going to hit everything. And one of the big things I want to take away from this is to pay attention to this idea. When we talk about intersections, historically, people picked the boxes for us. They said, all right, blacks over there, Latinx over there, gays over there, veterans over there, poor people over here, teens over there, et cetera, et cetera. The most powerful thing we can do when we talk about the concept of intersectionality is create an opportunity, and this might even look as tables, for people to define how they're going to talk about them, for people to tell their story. And that story might have bunch of different check boxes on it in terms of different cultural and social intersections. It might only have one. But a big takeaway I want you to pay attention to is look at how diverse the professional and social backgrounds are for these individuals, okay? We're all united in, yeah, sure, we all have mental health, but think about how each different platform and opportunity is a chance to make a gigantic impact on our mental health and on our benefit. This is technology, this is arts and expressions, this is creative digital platforms, this is direct services and hands on the ground, this is, and this is a big thing for everyone, mother trucking investment, okay? There's some dollars in there, okay?
Speaking of, we need some, so, you know, hit us up.
So what I want everyone to do is to take away from this intersectional panel is understanding that this should be a start to sort of kick off. I want you all to find these people online. We're going to have all their information. I want you to think about how you can get involved with them, how you can support them, how maybe you can learn to put your own table together. That's going to be my catchphrase of the day. But again, remember that the big key when we talk about this idea with mental health and intersectionality, the most powerful thing, if you're listening to everything they said here, is about being able to embrace your agency, to tell your story. And we want to move away from the default of somebody narrating who we are or are supposed to be. That's how we break out the boxes. So I want to give a gigantic hand to this amazing, beautiful panel. Y'all, some incredible people. Each one of you should have your own reality show. I want to thank this fantastic audience for sitting in. This has been Conversations Cafe on Intersectionality, presented by AFSP and Banyan Treatment Center. So thank you, everyone. Have a great day.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.